The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Terry Tapp is an artist and writer living in New York City. Originally from central Appalachia, Terry spent many years working trade jobs, wandering through the American South, and creating art and writing. His book, A Serf's Journal, is a formidable first-hand account of American workers in Jeffersonville, Indiana. It's a story of how they fought a multinational company and their own corrupt union to stage the longest wildcat strike in U.S. history. Tapp is a guest this week as we discuss overcoming capitalism. It's Wednesday, September 14th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you're looking for a book to help you understand late capitalism, pick up Anselm Japp's The Writing on the Wall, Chris Nynum's How the Establishment Lost Control, and of course, Angela Nagel's Kill All Normies, which is turning out to be a great conversation piece. It's guaranteed to transform any leftist get-together into a struggle session. If you enjoy this podcast, consider joining the Zero Books Club. And Zero Books Club members receive access to a Saturday podcast entitled Inside Zero Books, which this week will feature the second half of this conversation with Terry Tapp. Right now you're listening to the Unsquare Dance from the Baby Driver soundtrack. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Terry Tapp and I discuss overcoming capitalism. Both times I've had you at the Left Forum, I've invited you along. I've paired you with these sort of dry economists, you know, these Marxist economists. And I've done that kind of intentionally. I did that both times intentionally because I feel like what these economists have to say is so vitally important for the working class, but that it's not, you know, they don't deserve to be shunted off on their in their own little ghetto, that there should be a conversation between people like yourself, who I consider you to be working class, even though nowadays, I don't know, you're more of an artist. You're a little bit petty bourgeois, I guess, now. But back in your youth, you were certainly working class. So that's why I put you with them.
I do aspire to bougie. I'm talking with people. You know, I had a girlfriend one time that I took my children to a Shakespeare festival. And I brought some wine, and she was making fun of me bringing my children to a Shakespeare festival and drinking wine illegally, which is okay.
Yeah.
But she was raised with things like that, going to an orchestra. She was raised with all types of, you know, the niceties of a bougie life. Mm-hmm. And I am still aspiring to have those. I was treating my children one time here in New York City to some taco, raw octopus, which is delicious. And they were loving it. Or, well, they were loving me loving it. They actually hated the whole experience. But I told them, I said, you know, you have to understand where I come from and just recently come from. I said, and to be offered something, you know, you should at least try it, because most people don't have the opportunity to reject this.
Right.
So exactly. if I get, you know, some fancy coffee beans, when I, you know, growing up, they had white cans that had big black letters that said coffee. And then in expensive stores, you could get, you know, Maxwell House coffee. Here down the street here in Manhattan, you can get French roasted Brazil. Not everyone should have that. That should not be, and it's cheap too, actually. But so I aspire to bougie, and I let people know that.
I have a friend who was for years a member of Socialist Action, And they would get together. The head of Socialist Action would come into town in Portland. And they would get together, and he always liked to have caviar.
It angers me when this is the reverse.
Yeah, the socialist guy would say, you know, one day after revolution, there'll be caviar for the masses. So I kind of think that's fine. I mean, I knew another guy who was part of the ISO, and what he did was he threw away his pillows because he didn't want to, you know, be bourgeois. He wanted to be rugged and working class.
But what does that really mean? You know, I got very angry one time, irrationally angry maybe, at a young lady. Well, it was years ago, so I was younger then too. But I'd organized this big gathering with some other people, and we had socialist, anarchist, communist, the whole, you know, milieu of the left come and hang out and present for this weekend. And someone announced, I had this idea of a project that I still may do, I've kind of been doing, where I just painted and drew people on the various shitty jobs that have filled the majority of my life. Construction workers, steel fitters, other guys like this. And someone showed one of the paintings of a fellow that's actually on my website who passed away recently. And they showed him, and this girl said, "You did that on canvas." I said, "Yeah, I did this with the highest grade of material I could buy." And she said, "I paint people. I paint working people." And I didn't even want to say working people. It's just people with whom I've worked. But she said, "I paint working people, but I just paint them on cardboard because of the roughness and the rugged, primitive approach to." And I got upset. I stood up and unintentionally knocked my chair down, and I was ready to yell at her. I really hate that kind of approach to people. But, you know, I had to stop myself. I thought, why am I so angry at this? And I asked her about her background, where she comes from. She comes from some privilege. She's gone to a nice art school and things like that. This is wonderful. But I thought, you know, if the president of the United States, if the head of an oil company, if these people can be painted with care on linen, their image, that is, then the guy down the street, the guy on the corner begging for coins, he can be painted too in the same way. And the fact that you would make that distinction, that the ugliness of someone's life has to be replicated in this fashion, really upsets me.
It's a way that intellectuals have of feeling like a clergy.
If you throw away your pillows and, you know, never turn on the heat, even though you could afford to, because you want to live like a working man, you're just another kind of priest. You know, the working guy would love to have those pillows and probably has plenty of them, and certainly would turn on the heat if he was cold and he could afford to. So
some of that's truth to that.
So anyway, so let's talk about overturning capitalism, because it seems like with each passing year, that aim seems further away. I didn't think that it could seem further away than it did, say, 2 years ago, and yet it does.
Yes, so exactly.
How do we hold on to this ambition of a radical transformation of society?
I've been thinking a lot about that, and I've determined two things. That if I could state them kind of categorically, because things seem to be moving toward categorical statements. And I don't know if you noticed that, but you're with us or against us. I would never endorse such a bullshit statement. But with these Nazis in the street, I endorsed that. One thing I'm thinking as I'm getting older, middle-aged now, and I've done a lot, and I watched a lot of things crumble. Really good plans that people make. And I think that part of one statement I have to make is that most of what we think about and talk about on the left is fantasy. I think we have to come to grips with that. At different times in history, things have occurred, and a moment of success or near success has happened. Like for anarchists, the Spanish Civil War. that's always brought out, talked about, picked over, and it's beautiful. The uprising of the people is beautiful, not the outcome. But that happened only because of specifics to Spain at that time, specifics to its history, its organizing, and all the rest. It wasn't that a thing that can be moved to Oklahoma happened, a thing that can be moved to Kiev, and Kiev can have this. What happened happened only there and only at that time. It was a set of unique circumstances. So if we, you know, if we go and we try and wear their uniforms and say their words and so forth, this is silly and it's foolish at this time in the history of civilization to do that. I think what is wrong, though, is not simply that we have that we're living in a fantasy world, but that we're actually not living enough in the right fantasy world. I think that if we back away from it, we've offered, I'm putting myself in this as a leftist, we've offered nothing to people for so long, and what we did offer, what little we did offer, slide into identity politics, which is silly. It was slide into this, professional activism. So, and there, some of that's wonderful. Some of it's not. But it, you know, a lot of the time, anything that's professionalized feeds on its original mission to survive. So if you can't have a cancer society without cancer. So it needs cancer to perpetuate itself. You can't have a professional activist making good money, which they do. I've met some and talked with people about, you know, what they're bringing in. And some of it's very good. You couldn't have that job if the reason you have that job ceased to exist.
Yeah. Well, I'm reminded of, you know, almost two decades ago now, I can't believe it. I guess what, 16 years ago, when I was involved in the anti-war movement after the attacks of 9/11, and a debate that went back and forth in this group called PPRC, Portland Peaceful Response Coalition, as to whether or not we should focus on fundraising, becoming a nonprofit, and setting up a kind of institutional presence in Portland so that there would be an organization always ready to oppose the war and always ready to, you know, bring people to the streets and so on. And my response was, well, right, how about instead of focusing on the next war, we try to stop this one?
Yeah, you know, maybe the whole approach is wrong. Because what wars have we stopped? So maybe we need war. Maybe we need a different kind of war. Maybe something really needs to change with that. And I'm not promoting anything here yet. I'm just saying, maybe, you know, I was on social media a couple weeks ago, and Charlottesville, that horror had just happened. And a very good friend of mine said, what could we do to stop this happening again? And he mentioned that in Kentucky, where I'm from, and this guy is still living, there was going to be the next assembly of these assholes in Lexington. And I said, what you really need is five good snipers. And immediately someone attacked me and said, what you need is love and a million people expressing love. That's bullshit. And I'm not for, you know, Snoopy and all the rest listening in, advocating people do this. But I am advocating people do that in a way. I mean, if you had five good snipers, there's an incident that happened in the 30s in North Carolina where a lot of Native American people, a lot of African-American people, and some poor whites wanted to resist a Klan march into their community. So they ambushed them, and they shot a lot of them. And, of course, the Klansters had guns, and they shot back. But the Klan people never came back. They didn't like getting shot. This is a universal truth about people, pretty much, I guess. So if you talk about maybe the left needs to arm itself.
I don't know about that specific instance. I think that when you're talking about not just one local action, but say a national political crisis, that you have to operate on the level of politics rather than on the level of war. I mean, I know that war is just politics, you know, by another means. But the problem with arming ourselves, I mean, look, arming yourself, it's...
I'm not advocating that we go and fight a war against people.
Yeah, I know. But I just want to say, the problem with that is you never know who's on the other side. These days, especially, they don't dress in white robes. Also, if you are just shooting people in white robes, you might hit an Episcopal priest. I mean, you never know who...
Or a guy selling cheese.
Right. So you never know, you know... Vigilante justice just doesn't have the capacity to be justice. It's only it can be as a war, right?
Let me be very clear about that. I'm not advocating that. What I am advocating is that we change our idea about community defense and our idea about what we're looking at. If our actions in stopping a war have never worked, then we need to do something else. And I'm not, and I will be very clear, I'm not advocating arming ourselves to attack the government or to attack people, you know, starting the war. But I am wondering, like, if our approach is always an approach that fails, then we have to scrap that. Let me stop this for a second, because this just gets into these, like, shoot 'em up fantasies that everyone's having these days. And I don't mean that to put myself or anyone else down or up, but I mean, clearly this is a troubling time with that kind of stuff. I don't know if you saw about the Nazis going into Antioch. Antioch is the home of Antioch University, which is very liberal, very pro-feminist, very pro-left. And the police did nothing to stop these armed vigilantes in the streets. You can read about this online. There are more details coming out, but it's horrible. But I'm not advocating that. But let me say this: I was working the other day and I was listening to a discussion between Zizek and Will Self. And I don't want to advocate for Will Self because actually I don't know much about him. He made a couple of statements with which I completely disagree. So I don't want to take any position on him. But what was interesting to me is he really tried to pin down Zizek several times about what the hell Zizek was proposing politically.
Yeah.
And as you know, and I like Zizek's work philosophically, but he stumbled and obfuscated and did a juggling act. And finally, Will gave up. I think what we need to do is actually come up with some things that work. You know, my sentiments always lie with anarchism. But to me, the realization of actually existing freedom communally has to be some form of democracy. Because any form of anarchism that involves us making decisions together looks like some variant of anarchy. I mean, some variant of democracy. So in advocating through that channel democracy, I'm looking at what can we do politically, what institutions can be revived, what institutions can be created. And I don't like that I'm even thinking of institutions in this sense. But obviously, if we've turned away from them and everything we've done has failed, then we need to turn and look and see what is available. You know, I had an opportunity years ago, in the year 2000, that I passed on because for a lot of reasons. I was living in Louisville, Kentucky. Louisville and the county of Jefferson County that in which Louisville sits were going to merge. And I was living in a neighborhood that was very poor. Interestingly, the most racially mixed neighborhood of the city. And a neighborhood that voted Democrat. In the merger, the whole city was going to change the structure of the city governance. And they had the ombudsman, city councilors, all that had to rerun as council members, metro council members. The guy who was in my district was basically a lump. He'd done nothing for years. He was a retired sheriff, I believe. People had asked me to run. And at that time, Louisville had really experienced for several years a dramatic upswing in radical activity. And I can, and all attributable to a youth center, one single youth center that provided a place to hang out and, you know, your band to play and a little literature on workplace organizing and your rights and environmental racism and things like this. So that, that place and some other groups in Kentucky were behind me running. And I considered it. I talked with some people that were progressives, people with the, what they were calling the Black Caucus. And we came up with five things we could do to radically, dramatically change the community. And they, interestingly, it seemed boring to me, I have to say. But as boring as it would have been, we should have done it. I should have run. I would have been a shoe-in running against a, you know, someone who can't be disguised, you know, distinguished from a lump of clay. And but what we were going to do is put more youth centers in, have a restriction on brownfield development, you know, so you have to develop crumbling structures and structures that are already ready to be developed rather than develop new land if you're going to put a structure there. We're going to have a living wage, and it was $15 an hour we were shooting for. And we had what we thought were the resources to get it. It was five things. It was very straightforward. But those simple policies, if we had pushed them through, would have dramatically and radically changed the entire community in a way that leftists and protesting and these other types of activities had never been able to do. So what I'm thinking and what I was wondering that Zizek would say is, we need to have this new political party, or we need to have this new institution, or three new institutions, or just something that would be able to walk around and do things rather than just more idle talk and protest.
I think that when you start getting into specifics about what kinds of institutions are going to be vitally important in order to transform society, there are things to debate. For instance, you know, like a cultural center or a youth center may be really vitally important for a particular community and may help a lot in a variety of struggles. I don't see those kinds of institutions being enough to break capitalism itself. But, you know, that's – we can't do one thing and fix it, right? So yeah, I'm all for you. But the main thing – and I guess I like to think in the abstract maybe too much – is that what you talk about – and what the youth centers probably did is bring a sensibility of creativity and, I'm going to just say, art into the struggle.
Did other things, too. They actually, and this is very simple, they did two things that were remarkable. They provided a lot of literature, so an easy-to-handle literature, not 1,000 pages, but a trifold so that you could pull it out and say, oh, I'm getting screwed on wage theft. How do I deal with this? Very easy. And they, because it was a huge center, they rented out rooms to unions, to a group called Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, which is one of the best organizations I've ever seen of actual multi-platform organizing. They rented these things out. So what happened was people went to get a cup of coffee, and they talk to each other, and you find out that there's a strike going over here. You didn't know about it, but you're going to send people out, which is what we did, or that these people are going to protest mountaintop removal, and this company is actually engaging in environmental racism in the west part of Louisville. And you see how all of these concerns are interwoven, and you make friends. And that's really what that did. I'm not advocating a youth center to overthrow capitalism.
Part two of our revolutionary art. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Part two of our revolutionary art. Revolutionary art. Revolutionary art. Revolutionary art. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
In 1915, Malevich created a painting the world knows as Red Square, but that he titled A Peasant Woman in Two Dimensions. To Malevich, this painting was all about letting go of all manifestation but to the art world, he had created total abstraction in the development of constructivism.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
I am glad you do not like it. I can go farther and farther into the unknown wilderness of life. It is there where real transformation can take place.
Part 2 of our revolutionary art. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Part 2 of our revolutionary art.
1, 2, 3.
The revolutionary art.
7.
The revolutionary art. The revolutionary art. The revolutionary art.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
It's really important when you're organizing. This is something you said when we were in New York, that you speak to people's dreams and their creative ambitions and their actual real desires. Part of that, I think, would be to give people an opportunity to go beyond the kind of activity that they're forced into as workers. In other words, like, you know, in yes. organizing, you give someone the opportunity to make a mural or present them a speech or some way or another shine and develop and use the what they care about in themselves, you know, their own skills or their own passions.
So I think this is a major ingredient of what we're missing on the left. If you look back to the early 20th century, working people, which is just everyone almost, working people were reading about science. They were experimenting. They were inventing. They were going to Chautauquas. I don't know if that's a tradition up north or where, but I know in the south, and I know where they still call it Chautauqua Park in the western Kentucky. They would have the Chautauquas where they would bring speakers in, and the speakers would talk about new developments in, food storage, or they would talk about how we're going to be able to fly at some point, or wonderful things, crazy things, mundane things, but advances, improvements in your life, wonders. So working people were doing these things. I heard a talk where Chomsky was asked if he thought that people really just wanted to hang out, watch TV, and eat ice cream. And he said, I couldn't disagree more. And he brought up some of what I brought up now, I am bringing up, and I did bring up at Left Forum. People want to be artists. People want to be lazy. People want to learn new skills and have crazy experiences. Most people do. They don't want you to tell them that if you work very hard, I'm going to increase your wage by $4. That's great. But you're still stuck in the same goddamn job. Nobody likes that. You know, when I was a kid, I used to get a headache thinking about, I was listening to my papa, my grandfather, and he was a welder, a pipe fitter, you know, and my uncles were, my father was a laborer, you know, and they were all in the union, and they were talking about their lives. And I was looking down the barrel of that bullshit, and I didn't want anything to do with it. I wanted to see, at that age, at least, if how far magic could be real. You know, I wanted to see if I could experiment with some of the crazy stuff I was reading about in books. I wanted to paint, draw. I didn't want to do that. And so if someone came to me at that age and told me that a lot of hard work would get me a better TV set, a better pair of shoes, would get me $4 more an hour, I couldn't give a damn. You know, and that's how I think most people feel today. Look at the awful lives most people live. They're jello. And so you're telling people your life is shit. You have this crap to watch on TV. Some of it's not crap, I understand, but most of it is. You're still passively just consuming this shit. And if you work very hard and don't be a sexist or a racist and evolve, you're still going to be sitting there like a piece of jello watching this bullshit on TV, looking at these clowns in politics, you know, living a life that is no better than an amoeba. And for all the amoebas listening, some of my best friends are amoebas.